Many introductions of Angela Davis begins with, "She needs no introduction." And on many levels, this is true. Most people know of Angela Davis, the political prisoner from the early 1970s, who was first fired from her job in the University of California system for her revolutionary political views, and then jailed, and then became an international symbol of resistance to US racism and imperialism. Most people know Angela Davis, who for the past three decades has fought against the prison industrial complex and for the abolition of prisons. Most people know Angela Davis as a staunch anti-capitalist, standing against the ravages of capitalist greed and exploitation in the world. Most people know Angela Davis, the international human rights fighter, who has forged solidarity not just through statements, but through relationships and in action, through ongoing campaigns for those struggling for freedom from Australia to South Africa to Palestine. Many people know Angela Davis, the brilliant intellectual, radical thinker and writer, who has given us books like Women, Race, and Class, which was the first solid text on intersectionality before there was intersectionality, on blues legacies and black feminisms, and the meaning of freedom. Many people know what Angela Davis has done, but sometimes we don't acknowledge the importance of how she has done that work. I have had the good fortune to watch her do that work up close over many years. She has done it with humility, grace, and fierce determination, with patience and steel will resolve, always with love and compassion. I especially want to lift up and focus on the work that Angela has done around Palestine, which has been truly extraordinary. I had the privilege to join her on a small delegation of women of color in 2011, and that experience was transformative for all of us. We went to Hebron and saw the violent face of the occupation in a city divided with Palestinians under hostage. We visited the refugee camps and saw the conditions that resemble poverty in our communities in the U.S. We met with prisoner rights groups such as Adamir and others, and we were reminded of the crime of mass incarceration in the U.S. We met with the amazing scholars and students, many of them former prisoners, at Birzeit University, and we were reminded of the struggle for the right to education in the United States. Many former prisoners we met were moved by the privilege of meeting Angela. They had known of her struggle and known of her case when they themselves were imprisoned in Israeli jails. One thing we were asked over and over when we were there is that we should come back to the United States, we should travel wherever we go, and speak about the occupation in Palestine, speak about what we saw about the injustices of the occupation and Israeli policy. Repeatedly, Angela promised to do that, and she has, perhaps more than any of us, made good on that promise. On a bumpy road to Nablus, she pushed us, the delegates that is, to craft what became a very powerful statement of solidarity. She participated in the Russell Tribunal. She has spoken from one end of this country to the other on this issue, despite criticisms and challenges and sometimes silences. And it is consistent with that tireless commitment that she comes to us to Chicago this afternoon to stand with our sister Rasmea O'Day. And please join me in welcoming Angela Davis to the stage.
Oh. Let's see if the mic works. Is it working? Should I move it? No, okay. Good afternoon, everyone. It's really amazing to be here. And first of all, let me thank Barbara for that amazing introduction. I felt like my coming up would be anticlimactic. But let me echo Nadine. Oh, wow, this isn't working, huh? Should I hold it, you think? Okay, is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me echo Nadine in pointing out that this event was conceived last spring when Razmiya and I spoke at the conference here in Chicago organized by Beth Ritchie and a number of others who have been involved in keeping the movement, the organization called Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. Keeping that organization afoot. And it was the 15th anniversary of Insight. Well, this is not really working well at all. Where are the sound people? Who's in charge of the sound? I mean, this should be a very simple technical issue. But let me say that was a very exciting conference which brought together a cluster of issues related to racial and gender violence. And a number of us remarked, I remember, that we were able to recognize that we are in the midst of or at the beginning of what may very well turn out to be a new historical conjuncture. A new historical conjuncture that allows us to place radical social, political, and economic change on our agendas. Before I say anything else, I want to acknowledge the indigenous people who are the original inhabitants of the land on which we convene this afternoon. And of course, the very names, Chicago and Illinois, both reveal and conceal the violence of settler colonialism directed against the first peoples of this land. You're working on the sound? Okay, 2 minutes. Well, let me say that it's really great to be in Chicago again. It seems like I come to Chicago every month. You know? And Frank Chapman, reminded me that actually we founded the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression in this very city in 1973. And there's another person who was in the leadership of that organization who's here, and I'd like to ask her to stand up. Josephine, I'm talking about you. Josephine Wyatt. And this is her 94th birthday today. And as I was reflecting on her case, I remembered many, many years ago, and Frank already evoked that time, when I was in jail. And I received a letter from James Baldwin, an open letter. And I thought it might be appropriate to share a small portion of that letter, which actually became a tool, an organizing tool all over the world. And so James Baldwin wrote, "We know that we, the blacks, and not only we, the blacks, have been and are the victims of a system whose only fuel is greed, whose only God is profit, We know that the fruits of this system have been ignorance, despair, and death. And we know the system is doomed because the world can no longer afford it, if indeed it ever could have. And we know that for the perpetuation of this system, we have all been mercilessly brutalized and have been told nothing but lies. Lies about ourselves and our kinsmen and our past, and about love and life and death, so that both soul and body have been bound in hell. The enormous revolution in Black consciousness which has occurred in your generation, my dear sister, means the beginning or the end of America. Some of us, white and black, know how great a price has already been paid to bring into existence a new consciousness, a new people, an unprecedented nation. If we know and do nothing, we are worse than the murderers hired in our name. If we know, then we must fight for your life as if it were our own, which it is, and render impassable with our bodies the corridor to the gas chamber. For if they take you in the morning, they will be coming for us that night. Therefore, peace, Brother James. And I read this because it expresses the stance we have to cultivate in ourselves, in our communities, in relation to the campaign to free Razmir. We know that the attack on Razmir is an attack not only on the individual, but also on all of us who identify with the struggles with which she is involved. I identify with her because I know that it is through individuals that entire movements are attacked. I knew when I was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted lists, that it would have made no sense to put a single person on that list in that way, unless the target were much larger. Unless through that means it was possible to send messages to the movement, and especially to black women. And so that very act, in many ways, was an act of terror. We all know that Asata Shakur, as Barbara pointed out, has been placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted terrorist list. And we know that through Asata, they are attempting to send messages to the beautiful young activists who are emerging all over this country and doing such important work, including the sister who climbed up that pole and ripped down the Confederate flag. So Razmir is the specific target, but through her, Palestinians who resist the occupation here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world, and of course in occupied Palestine, are under attack. But she also bears the brunt of an attack that is directed against the ever-expanding movement for a free Palestine. The expansion of students for justice for Palestine, of Jewish Voice for Peace, the increasing numbers of young black students who recognize Palestine as their generation's South Africa, and as a matter of fact, students at Stanford University, where I've been teaching most recently, in connection with solidarity with Ferguson last spring, flooded the freeways, stopped traffic on the freeways. And then everyone was totally stunned because these black students unfurled a Palestinian flag. I also want to place Rasmea's case within a context that permits us to recognize the ongoing repression directed at this country's political prisoners. And of course, there are too many to name. But I do want to mention the name of Lynette Peltier. And Mumia Abu-Jamal. And there are many former members of the Black Panther Party behind bars, still behind bars. And I'm thinking of Mando Waylanga and Ed Poindexter in Nebraska. Let's remember that next year, 2016, will mark the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. So what I think we should do, this is, how many more years does Obama have? Okay, so what we need to do is to develop the kind of pressure that will force him to take a position on the political prisoners who are still behind bars. And, you know, Obama seems to be on a roll now, right? There's health care and housing, and then, of course, marriage equality, and he even sang the other day. So let's let him know that if he really wants to exit his presidency in a dramatic way, he can grant clemency to political prisoners in this country. Of course, there are a whole range of struggles that we can evoke that are linked to our campaign to free Rasmea and to end the occupation. Our ongoing struggles against racist violence in the U.S. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to spend time in Ferguson. As a matter of fact, I'm coming. It was a little late because my flight from St. Louis didn't land on time. And I was able to touch the ground where Mike Brown was killed. I was able to meet with many Ferguson activists, the protesters who are African American, who are Latino, Asian American, Palestinian, a large group of Palestinians who live in St. Louis have been on the line every day in Ferguson. And of course, and white protesters. Often we, through the media, we don't understand the diversity of that movement. And we assume that because one of the major slogans is Black Lives Matter, that it is primarily a Black movement. But I heard what the young brother, Rick, was saying. The question he was asking, you know, what if Black were human? You know, what if one could use the term Black to talk about humanity? And I'll address that if I have time. But what impressed me so much about the time, the short time I spent in St. Louis, was that, you know, as the name of Ferguson has resounded all over the world, everybody knows Ferguson. I have some former students who teach at Washington University in St. Louis, and one of them was saying that she was doing some research in Russia, and they asked her where she was doing the research, and she said, well, in St. Louis. Nobody had heard of St. Louis. And then she said, Ferguson. And I said, oh! And I mentioned to the protesters that I've spoken many times about Mike Brown and Ferguson, both inside and outside the country. And for me, as for people all over the world, the very mention of Ferguson evokes struggle and perseverance and courage and a collective vision of the future. And I was telling them that last September, I was invited to speak in Savona, Italy. I don't know if you know where Savona is. It's near Genoa. And Savona's claim to fame is that Christopher Columbus lived there. But I went there because in this small town, well, it's 60,000 people, that's a small town. They had been inviting me for years to come and participate in some event to free the Cuban Five. And because they were so persistent, every year they asked me if I would come. And so finally I said, I think I have to visit these people who are so persistent. And so so I went to participate in an event to free the Cuban Five. At that point, two were still in prison. And as you know, they were the last two were released this past December. And I think that at this very moment in Johannesburg, they're holding big celebrations, you know, for the Cuban Five. And all of you know the Cuban Five, right? Yeah, yeah. But when I got to this town, Savona, all the people were talking about was Ferguson. And they wanted to hear about Mike Brown and Ferguson because they felt so deeply inspired to continue the struggle to free the Cuban Five by what was happening, by what they perceived was happening in Ferguson. And then, of course, we know that last summer, not long after the protests happened, and let me say that, you know, they're still protesting. It's amazing. It's really amazing. And at an event yesterday, of course, you know, some of the people were saying that, you know, they're burnt out and there's conflict, and that is inevitably going to happen. And they were wondering what the next step. was. And my position was, well, if you do nothing else than what you have already done, you have changed the world, you know, by your persistence and by refusing. By refusing to treat that case as just another case of police violence. Because oftentimes we've experienced these sort of explosive responses, but then people forget and they go home. And then the next one happens. But they refuse to go home, even when they experience the people who could not control their rage and acted in ways that were counterproductive. They're still going strong. They're still protesting. This is perhaps this lasted much longer than Occupy, right? How long did Occupy last? And almost as long as the Montgomery bus boycott. So we know that shortly after the protests started, a Palestinian delegation visited Ferguson. And there's a powerful statement. You can find it online. And then there was a strategic visit to occupied Palestine by young activist groups. From the Black Lives Matter, we actually saw the video of a demonstration that I think took place in Nazareth, right? Organized by the group and Patrice Cullors, who's one of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matter. And there's Dream Defenders, We Charge Genocide, Justice League, and BYP 100. And these groups and others have communicated to young activists all over the country that we have to focus on what is going on in Palestine. They know about the occupation. They know that despite all of the talk about conflicts between the Obama and Netanyahu administrations, the U.S. still remains the major supporter of the occupation. If the U.S. withdrew support for Israel, the occupation would be over tomorrow. Absolutely. And we know that last summer, Palestinian activists helped Ferguson activists via Twitter. And as a result of that connection, some of the major demands that we are making have to do with that consciousness that emerged as a result of that connection. Demilitarization of the police. Demilitarization of the police. I mean, what is so interesting is that as a result of that connection, we began to learn that you cannot simply focus on individual perpetrators, which is the way movements had unfolded in the past. Make sure the perpetrator is, quote, brought to justice. But now, anti-racist activists in this country know about the occupation. They know about the segregated highways on the West Bank. They know that farmers are restricted from their land. They know that there are about 500,000 Jewish settlers on the West Bank as compared to the 3.5 million Palestinians. But the settlers use something like 90% of the West Bank's water. They know about the various boycotts. And I have to say that in the airport, I was looking for something to eat, and I saw Sabra hummus. And I said, and before I knew, years ago, before I knew about Veolia, I always took Super Shuttle. And we know about SodaStream, right? And we know that G4S has emerged as a central focus of the efforts of BDS. And not very long ago, some 20 South African businesses terminated their contracts with G4S Security, specifically over its involvement in Israeli prisons and the human rights abuses there. Since we're talking about BDS, and since the Pride Parade, is it over yet? Is there anybody here who went to Pride? Okay. Oh, yes. And since the Supreme Court decision on marriage equality just came down 2 days ago, it seems that we should make some connections here and say, first of all, how absolutely essential it is to struggle against homophobia and transphobia. But also how we cannot assume that these struggles can be disassociated from struggles against settler colonialism and racism and economic justice. And we recognize that the marriage equality decision was absolutely important as a within the framework of civil rights. But we know from the last half century that civil rights do not mean freedom. Yeah. Civil rights do not mean freedom. And we know that marriage is still an institution that bears the imprint of heteropatriarchy and capitalism, even in its same-sex instantiation. And I mention this because Israel continues to engage in pinkwashing. As a matter of fact, the mayor of Seattle, Ed Murray, was just recently invited to participate in the Pride Parade in Tel Aviv. And people told him that there was a boycott, and he still went. He should have talked to Lauryn Hill, who canceled her Tel Aviv concert. I don't think I have very much longer. Well, no, we're here to make community. No, we're here to experience each other as comrades in the struggle. And I just feel so honored to be here. I'm so happy to be able to experience this myself. And it's not, this is something that I have to do. It's not like a big deal, right? It's not something I have to think about. And I hope that we all feel that way, that there are places we have to be. And there's no question about it. Okay, absolutely. And, you know, I'm thinking back on my visit yesterday and today with the protesters in Ferguson. And I just so appreciate their perseverance and the fact that they just kept going out there. Because if it hadn't been for that, we probably would not have been driven to focus our attention on Eric Garner. Because remember, the Eric Garner case happened before Mike Brown was killed. It was the response to the failure to indict the
cop and the release of that video that happened as protesters in Ferguson were continuing. And then, of course, Tamir Rice and Walter Scott in South Carolina and Freddie Gray in Baltimore. And if it hadn't been for Ferguson, we would not have generated the discussion about black lives that are not simply black male lives. And so we're talking about Miriam Carey in Washington, D.C., and Rakia Boyd right here in Chicago, and Alicia Thomas in Los Angeles. Had it not been for the Ferguson protesters, who also pointed out that black women and people of color and queer communities and Palestinian activists were targets of officially condoned racist violence, we might not have achieved such a broad consciousness of the work we have to do to build a better world. We might not have experienced the terrible tragedy in Charleston in ways that have brought people together all over the world who now recognize that racism is indeed alive and well 15 years into the 21st century. And of course, we have to focus on more than individuals and symbols. And many people are, you know, were not convinced by the families who forgave the perpetrator in Charleston. And they said, you can't forgive that easily. But I believe they said what they said from the bottom of their hearts. And also what those acts accomplished was to deflect attention away from the individual perpetrator so that we could begin to address all of the other issues surrounding racism, the structural racism. It's not just a young man gone bad. And that message was that we have to focus on more than individuals and symbols. I mean, it's good that after all these years of openly symbolizing resistance to civil rights and black equality, and symbolizing anti-black and also anti-Semitic violence, the Confederate flag seems like it's on its way out. Seems like it's on its way out. And like I said, I really appreciate the fact that there's this young black woman who said, I don't care about the legislature in South Carolina. I'm gonna take this flag down myself. But of course, focusing only on the flag is the easiest solution. It's very interesting that in the last period of Obama's presidency, the Pandora's box of racism has been yanked wide open. And usually what happens is that there's this rush to close it again, right? But it can't be closed now. And when Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson and the movement refused to disband, and even when people began to criticize the movement by saying, this can't be a real movement because there are no leaders. You know, where are your leaders? And the movement said, well, I don't think we need the traditional male charismatic leader. And, you know, I always point out that I really love Martin and Malcolm. I really do. But this is the 21st century. And we have learned that leadership is not a male prerogative. And besides, women have always done the work. They've always done the work. So women can be in the leadership. Radical black women, queer black women, who have a very different notion of what it means to lead. And Barbara Ransby just wrote this amazing article, which I read on Portside. Where was it published originally? It was published in Color Lines, and it's on precisely that issue. What's the title, Barbara? You remember?
Ella taught us.
And so Barbara points out that they say this is not a leaderless movement. This is a leaderful movement. A leaderful movement. And you know, when I was there yesterday, I acknowledged the fact that Hillary Clinton had come through. She came through Ferguson, and she had to make her race speech in an appropriate venue. And what was really interesting was that she said, "All lives matter." And I was really surprised that her people hadn't explained to her, you know, that universal proclamations have always bolstered racism, that they've always been clandestinely racialized. So no one told her about the tyranny of the universal and the violence done to black people and people of color by the very fact that the category human has been racially exclusive. And that's why it's so important to ask that question, can't black be human? And so what if those who are at the very bottom of the hierarchy begin to symbolize the emergence of humanity and democracy, then that means that everybody will be free, as Razmiya so eloquently pointed out. I was beginning to say, okay, you know, Hillary's trying to... She should have looked at the Black Lives Matter website. Because she would have seen that on that website they say, black women matter, black girls matter, black gay lives matter, black bi lives matter, black boys matter, black queer lives matter, black men matter, black lesbians matter, black trans lives matter, black immigrants matter, black incarcerated lives matter, black differently abled lives matter. Which means, of course, Latino lives matter, and Asian American, and Native American, and Muslim, and poor and working class people's lives matter, and Palestinian lives matter. So, what if black were human? Contrary to what Obama said 2 days ago, we need to talk about race. He said, and I appreciate the, and I, you know, you're right, I was duly impressed. But I did disagree with the fact that he said we don't need any more talk about race. We need to start doing. We don't even have a vocabulary that permits us to have insightful conversations about race. So how can we do what we need to do? And there's such a shallow consciousness of racism that is promoted that it's assumed that all you need to do is one thing. You know, get rid of the flag. Stop using the N-word. He acknowledged that, I guess. But in this connection, people ask, well, you know, what is this thing between black people in the U.S. and Palestinians? What does black have to do with Palestinian? And as Mia pointed out, that connection has a very long history. But now, especially Black solidarity with Palestine allows us to understand the nature of contemporary racism more deeply. As a result of that connection, we have learned how important it is to challenge settler colonialism as an essential dimension of our struggle against racism. Settler colonialism in the United States of America and settler colonialism in Palestine. But of course, we have to go further. The importance of understanding the pivotal role of sexual violence here. Sexual violence as a political tool. And we should applaud Razmia for her courage in speaking out about the sexual assault she experienced in Israel. And this allows us to understand that the struggle against racism cannot go forth without linking sexual violence to police and vigilante violence. And of course, I could continue. But I want to conclude here because we need time to make community. And, you know, recently it has occurred to me that oftentimes we develop our demands based on what we think we might be able to achieve. And in that sense, we really water down our demands. And sometimes we even forget what we really want. And so I think we need to start demanding what we want, what we really want, not what we think we can get. And so we clearly want a civilian police accountability council. But we want to demilitarize the police, completely demilitarize the police. We want to disarm the police. As a matter of fact, all of these conversations about gun regulations, let's just take guns away from everybody. And especially the police. So that would mean, of course, that we would have to abolish the institution of the police as we know it, and we would have to begin to imagine different kinds of security. We would have to begin to ask, what does security really mean? And then we would have to talk about housing and healthcare and education and all of those things. And of course, we would have to abolish imprisonment as the dominant mode of punishment. We want an end to the prison nation. And what do we want? We want to end the occupation of Palestine. And what do we want right now? We want justice for Razmia. Justice for Razmia. Thank you.